the fourth bi-monthly meeting of the Sacramento Area Council. I'd like to open the meeting with a moment of silence, a silent prayer to do with your will or a quiet time. And it might be wise if we spent this particular quiet time in memory of Jack L., who was a member of group number 2, who left these halls yesterday and is with our great master. May we have a moment of silence.
Too much for it. But there is one who has all power, and that one is God. May you find him now.
measures. Half measures availeth nothing. Let us say half measures availeth half, or 90% measures availeth 90%. It says half measures availeth nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care, and once again, with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which is suggested in the program of recovery. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives become unmanageable. Step two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Step three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. And step four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Step five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrong. Step six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all of these defects of character. Step seven, humbly ask Him. Simply humbly ask Him to remove our shortcomings. Step eight, made a list of all persons we'd harmed and became one, simply willing to make amends to them all. Step nine, made direct demands to such people wherever possible, except when to do so. Except when to make such demand would injure them or others. And step 10, continue to take personal inventory each day, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. Step 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, asking only for two things. In each prayer, as you and I say, we only have to ask for two things. One is praying only for the knowledge of His will for us, and two is the power to carry that out. You and I in our daily prayer and ask for something that all we forevermore have to ask for is simply, God, what is it that you want me to do, and God, give me the guts to do it. Step 12, having had a spiritual awakening, as a result of those steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics, and then perhaps most important of all, to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of them exclaimed, what an order, I can't go through it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like adherence to these principles, perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that you and I are willing to grow along spiritual lines. These principles that have been set down for us are simply guides to progress. We claim only spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. We had expected that we would have the past, present, and future delegates of panel one. Okay, Posey, Nick Nickerson, and the present one, Sam Wilsey, but unfortunately, they were unable to attend the meeting, okay, Posey and Nickerson, because their wives are ill, and Wilsey because he is having to work until midnight tonight. On the other hand, we have the past and present representatives of panel two, Floyd Bauer, might stand up and let us just give him a hand. And Vic Maloney. Burn, who was a baker. And on this side of the table next to me was my sponsor, who is a self-styled inventor. And I recall walking into this meeting, and I excused myself before it started, and I walked outside of that church, and I stood under a huge oak tree, and I said to myself, this is fantastic. This shouldn't happen to a dog. Here I am, a physician and surgeon, licensed to practice in this glorious state of California. It so happens that while I'm a surgeon, I was also trained as a psychiatrist. I don't do psychiatry. I could just turn my collar out and do so if I wanted to, but I don't. But nonetheless, I am a member of that great society. Someone once said to me in the early days of AA, there's nothing worse than a confused psychiatrist. I said, here I am, a physician and surgeon, a diplomat of one of the great specialty boards of these United States, a fellow of the American College of Surgeons, a fellow of the International College of Surgeons, and even a member of the Psychiatric Society. And I've got to go into that place to have the butcher and the carpenter and the baker make a man out of me. Well, if I live 100,000 years and I've spent 24 hours a day being at the beck and call of those four men, it would be impossible for me to break even. My gratitude is exceedingly deep. And I might say that the four of them are still working on it. And it was some months after I'd been on the program, and I had a little trouble about this will business. And so I went to a friend's house who was an AA and had been very kind to me, and there I met a man who had given a very fine speech and which had touched me very deeply. And I said to this man, what's all this business about will? What's all this business about my will and the old man's will upstairs? How do I know what's my will? How do I know what's his will with a capital H? And this man looked at me benevolently, as he has many times since that time, and he said, Earl, any time that you treat one of your patients with the idea that she'll go out and send you another patient, that you talk. But any time you treat one of your patients just simply kindly, that's the old man talking. So at that particular minute, it began to dawn on me what this program was. Now this man is sitting to my right tonight, and I'm not going to introduce him in eloquent words, because it would be impossible to think of sufficient numbers of superlatives to introduce him to you. And the reason I'm not going to use those superlatives is I was reminded of a recent trip to New York in a conversation that I happened to have with Bill, our great founder. And I looked at him and said, I suppose too much so. I said, you have no idea what a fantastic opportunity this is to me to be able to shake your hand. And he looked at me and he said, what the hell's the matter with you? Don't you know I put my trousers on just like you do, one leg at a time? However, with the deepest of reverence to one of our simple members of AA, I give you Chuck C. from Los Angeles. Thank you all, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's nice to be asked to talk, but it's nicer to be asked back. It always gives me quite a tingle to be asked back someplace to do something, because it's so different from the way that it used to be. Patience is a great thing. I think one of the measures that I use on myself to see how I'm progressing is how easy it is for me to say I don't know.
Now, it's a great load off our backs when we don't have to maintain ourselves as an authority on everything from nuclear physics to the love life of the Eskimo. And I think perhaps one of the reasons that Dr. Earle is with us this evening is because of my ignorance. I sat and talked with him for about an hour and 30 minutes, and I was using him a little bit roughly, I think, because every time he got out of line, I put my foot right in his mouth. And after an hour and 30 minutes out, I said to him, what's your name? I don't even know your name. And he says, well, I'll tell you who I am. And when he got through, I said, well, I'm glad I'm sitting down, because if I hadn't been sitting down, I'd fall down with me. So I have to tell you a little something about one of your own members here. O ye of little faith, Maloney. What I gave up last year, they had made all the arrangements, and he had harassed you people into coming out, and so he was going to have a pretty nice crowd, and he came over to the plane to meet me, and I got off the plane and found him at the edge of the crowd, looking quite dejected, and I tapped him on the shoulder, and I said, do you have a problem? He sort of came to, and he took me down to the hotel, and said, now I'll leave you to get ready, and I'll come back and get you, and we'll have dinner together. And so I said, that's fine, I want to get a little pressing done, and I'll have plenty to do, so you come back and get me. And so I got to my room and called the valet service, and it was extinct. He'd gone home for the night. And I said, well, is there anything else in Sacramento open that I might get a little pressing done? He said, no. Well, I thought to myself, that's all right, I'll just go and wrinkle. And I put my suitcase on the bed and opened it up, and all hell broke loose. I had a brand new bottles, large size bottle of Cremo hair pot. And up at about 15,000, it exploded. And it was all over two coats, the right side of two coats, and the top of one pair of trousers, and the knees of the other. And the valet service was gone. And I thought, well, it's too bad, but there's nothing to do, so I hung the things over the and went in and shaved and took a bath, and every once in a while I'd run out and press the trousers, you know. Making the best of it. And finally, at the same time, and there was a knock on the door, and I said, come in. And the door opened, and they said this face about that long, and he didn't move. Well, I said, come on in, you stupid. What's the matter with you? So he moseyed into the room, and I told him what happened, and he sort of came to life again, and we went out to dinner, and came to the meeting, and then went to the club, and finally took me back home and said, we'll have breakfast together. And so the next morning, he called me for breakfast, and we slipped into a booth to eat, and he looked over at me and he says, oh, ye of little faith, oh, ye of little faith. And I said, what's the matter, Vic? Well, he says, I come to the airport to meet you and you don't get off the plane. He's never seen me with my hat off, and he didn't recognize me, you see. And here he was with a big meeting and no speaker. And then I tapped him on the shoulder and he came to. And then he came back to get me to take me to dinner, and he opened the door, and nothing but a heart in the place. He said, oh, my God, look at me. He you very much for asking me to come by again. It's already been very much worthwhile. I think one of the great advantages of the circuit rider is to be able to look out on so many happy faces and just cast back into memory a few years and think what you all looked like then. It's a great thing. Perhaps the most meaningful words in the English language to me are the many words that explain what this fellowship is. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other. That's the other thing that is. Share our experience, strength, and hope with each other. And when we think of the almost absolute aloneness that is the lot of the practicing alcoholic, the time comes when we're all alone, 1,000,000 miles from no place, right in the middle of a long time. And to think that there is a society that asks no questions but is willing to share its experience, strength, and hope with us. It's terrific. I love Bill's little explanation of this society of ours. He says it's just you helping me and the two of us helping somebody else. I think that's terrific. And I have come to believe that the words aren't so meaningful between us. It's not so much what he said, but the example that carries the impact. I come to believe that the only right I have to keep, even in my own home, is by example. And perhaps the most meaningful thing about my appearance here this evening is simply this. That when I was a hopeless, helpless drunk, today I didn't have to take a drink. Thank God. Whereas I was one of the most miserable amongst men, today I'm reasonably happy. And I have a degree of peace and of joy and life. This, I think, is meaningful. Much more meaningful than the word. And the reason for this change is very meaningful to me. I know what I did with my own life. I had 43 years to run my life. I was the director of energy, the program chairman, for 43 years. And at the end of 43 years, I was a failure in every department of life. I not only was a failure as a drunk, and I did a good job of that, but I was a failure in every department of life. I was a failure as a father, a failure as a husband, a failure as a businessman, and a failure as a man at 43. And I know who did that, because I was calling the shots. That was my doing. And now the change that has taken place has all taken place since I got a new driver. And I know from whence that came also. This is what God has wrought. And it is with a gratitude that I haven't the slightest possibility of expecting that I stand here to do. Because this I did not do. And I think that we shall talk about three of the pairs in Alcoholics Anonymous tonight. There are a lot of pairs in Alcoholics Anonymous, but I've been playing with three of them lately, and I've had a lot of fun out of it. I get on tangents get on a kick that I can't get off of until I've left to dry completely. And this I haven't quite left dry yet. I don't know yet what I'm talking about. Well, I'll talk about it again tonight. And I understand why I think that's a yes. But I don't understand it yet. So we'll play with it a while. I used to fancy myself as a poker player. And if one gets caught with three pairs in his hand in a poker game, particularly if the stakes are high, we're able to find ourselves in a lot of trouble. And I think that if we drop out, regardless of how long or how short a time that we might have been around the program, if we get caught without an awareness of these three pairs, we're liable to be in a lot of trouble. True. Because here the stakes are high. The difference between sanity and insanity. In my case, the difference between life and death. And the two prayers are these. The twofold nature of the disease of alcoholism itself. Alcoholism is a disease of a twofold nature, an allergy of the body coupled with an obsession of the mind. Physical and mental. The twofold nature of the recovery program, we admitted that we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable, physical and mental. And the twofold nature of the end result, physical sobriety coupled with the AA way of life. Now the first member of the pair, let's think a little about the physical side of the disease first. The few little points that we should remain constantly aware of about this physical deal is that it's of a permanent nature. Once an alcoholic, always an alcoholic. But there is no such thing as an alcoholic recrossing the line and becoming a normal drinker yet. I'm mindful of the first trip, I believe it was, that Dr. Jelinek was out our way. Dr. Jelinek of the Yale Institute of Alcoholic Studies, the Yale Clinic. It's about 7 or 8 years ago now. And he told us at that time they had 50,000 cases of alcoholics. And not one case on record where an alcoholic had ever gone back to normal drinking. And I think this is something that we should be constantly aware of. All authorities tell us that once we have lost the ability to react normally to alcohol, if we ever have such ability, we never get it back. Secondly, that the physical part of the disease doesn't bother us until we take a drink. Now, I haven't had a drink for something over 9 years, and I don't hurt any place. That's the problem, it hurts. I haven't even got a hit. I don't know. And I have an idea that I might live 99 years without even being aware of the fact that I had a physical allergy of alcohol, to alcohol. If I never take a drink of liquor. It's the first drink of liquor that sets up the physical allergy, that starts the craving. That will not be denied. And so, we mustn't forget when we've been sober for a while, and when we're feeling pretty good, that allergy is still there. We must be constantly aware of that. We must also be aware of the fact that there is no cure for the physical side of this thing. If we have $10 million, there's no place we can go to buy a way that we might drink normally. This is something that we should always remember. We should further remember that over any considerable period of time, this thing gets worse, never better. Our physical ability to react normally to alcohol gets less and less, even during long, extended periods of total sobriety. Total absence. We get less able to react normally to alcohol. This is a peculiar thing, because in many of the other disease, when you're well for a while, you build up a reserve, but not here. There is no such thing as building up any good drinking time. If we do at all. I like to speculate on this thing and have for years. It would seem to me only reasonable to believe that if a guy was sober a year, he could certainly have one more good drinking time. That is not reasonable at all to me. Now I've had 9 months built up. I didn't get a job for a while. But this is not the case. Even during this time, our ability to react normally to alcohol gets less. And all we have to do to prove this to ourselves is to get a hold of somebody that's had 5, 6, 8, 10 years of sobriety and has forgotten these things and has taken a short beer and then listen to him tell about the worst drug he's ever been on in his life. We always start where we left off and go on down from there. And we must constantly be aware of these things. Now, why is it that one who has had considerable trouble with alcohol can't decide to quit drinking and quit? Let's just use me for a horrible example. For a little bit. I was a periodic. Now I can understand how an habitual can keep right on drinking and never quit, you know, and just keep right on going. Because a habitual never gets well enough to quit, you know. They never do. But I was a periodic. And I had periods of total sobriety, physically. Why couldn't I say in the beginning of my last 5 years of a 25-year drinking career, after a lot of things had happened to me, why couldn't I during one of those sober periods say, well, this is no good, we'll put the cork in the bottle and leave. And I'd had some pretty good lessons by that time. I had been detained without my permission. And when you're detained, when you wake up in detention, after a long period with, let's say, absence, and there ain't no absence there, you die all the time. Because they won't bring any. And that's not good. I had considerable trouble by that time with music that had no visible means of support. I presume I told you something in this area, but it tickles me. I'm going to tell it to you. The first time I heard the music, when there wasn't any band around, I'd gone out to the kitchen to get a glass of buttermilk, and there was a teacher sitting on the stove, and the steam was coming out, steaming away, and right along with this steam came the most beautiful symphony you ever heard in your life. And I took a peek. I thought, my God, this thing turned into a receiving set. This is it. This is the greatest phenomenon that's ever happened in this part of the country. And after I'd enjoyed it a little bit, I herded the family into the kitchen to listen to the They couldn't hear a thing, and I thought they were nuts. But by this time, this was a familiar occurrence in my life, music. I had a lot of trouble with animals of varying sizes and colors, including many snakes. I had had to meet the people and talk with them. And they talked with me. And I could see them just as plain as I could see you, and they weren't even there. And that ain't good. But it's better than what comes a little bit later, because the voices are hung out here 6 feet in the air, and there's nobody there. It's sort of cozy when you can see them and they talk to you. But what voices are out here? It's not good. And there's nobody up there. And you know it, and you can't see from talking to it. And you're boop, 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 boop. Wear yourself out talking to these boys. I'd already fallen over on the floor in my face and chewed my tongue full of holes and babbled like an idiot. And none of that's good. Now, why shouldn't I have said to myself, look, big boy, this is no longer any fun. It's no fun for you, and it's no fun for anybody else. Let's quit it. Let's just put the cork in the bottle and put it away. Why can't you do that? Because that's the other half of the disease. The obsessions of the mind. You see, if we'd be alcoholics, by the time we wake up to the fact that we have a problem, it's too late to make up our minds to quit drinking. A decision to stop drinking is worthless. It's just like a tubercular deciding not to cough. Until the cause of the cough is gone, we're going to cough. And until the cause of the drinking is gone, if we be alcoholics, we're going to drink. Because we are no longer willful drinkers, we are compulsion drinkers. We drink by compulsions that are greater than we are. So our decision is not to quit drinking, but that we can't quit. That's the great decision we are on. This is the reason I can no longer think of the disease of alcoholism as one thing, as a thing apart, and life as another. I can't think of it that way at all. This is a living problem, and we must find a living answer. Because the first drink is not of a physical origin. It is of a mental origin. And we have to get rid of the causes for our drinking. And they are living causes. And we have to find a living answer. This is the reason I love that first step in our program so much, the start of the second pair. We admitted that we were alcoholics, that our lives had become unmanaged. Now, it's pretty easy for an alcoholic to admit that he's powerless over alcohol for a little while. It's not at all difficult when you have those whips and jingles pretty bad to admit that you're powerless over alcohol. But it's not too easy to admit and accept the admission that our lives have become unmanaged. All we can and do, even admit a little insanity whilst we're drinking. We admit that we do some very screwy things while we're drinking. But when we're sober, we think we're pretty screwed operators. We're not so bad then, you know. We're pretty true. And it's not easy to admit that we're powerless over alcohol, that our lives have become unmanaged. This is the only difficult thing that any alcoholic will ever be called upon to do. This is the only hard part about the AA program, to admit defeat. And yet it is the very bedrock, the foundation under our sobriety. And the reason that I think the way I do is because I could not get sober and stay sober. And so I believe the book when it tells us that we must have help from a power greater than ourselves. Now this is as simple as ABCs to me. If I could have gotten sober and stayed sober, I would not be a member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. I didn't come here to improve my social position. I didn't even come here to investigate to see how to drink normally. I had already had it. I didn't even come close to this place until I'd done run out of gas. I'd completely run out of gas. And so I believe the book when it says that it's necessary for us to have help from the fire gate in itself. And I believe that the very first condition of getting this help is that we surrender, that we admit our own inadequacy and get out of our own way completely. You see, when we think that we can do this thing ourselves, we are in no position to get help at all. Not from man and not from God. Just as long as I said to myself, I'll beat this thing if it's the last thing I ever do, I got drunker and stayed there longer. And it came just that close to being the last thing I ever did. So, in my book, the most significant day in any alcoholic's life is that day when he can and does say, I'm all done. I'm licked. I can't get out of this thing alone. I must have help. That is the great day in our life. Again, I could not get sober and stay sober. So I had no fault to find with the book when it said we're like people who have lost their legs. We never go new. I certainly had no fault with the book where it said all of us at times during our drinking careers have stopped and looked at ourselves and saw that we weren't doing very well. Saw that we weren't living according to our own pattern. And we decided to do better. But we lacked the power. Lack of power was our dilemma, says the book. And it was obvious if we lacked the power, we had to find the power. And it was just as obvious that it must be a power greater than ourselves. I believe the book when it said, under certain conditions, certain circumstances, it seems that there's only one defense against that first drink, the drink we must not take. And that's help from a power greater than ourselves. And I reckon this is the reason that I go completely overboard, all out, without one reservation on earth, for the ABCs of this book. A, that I am an alcoholic and can't manage my own life. B, that no human power could relieve my alcoholism. C, that God could and would, if so. The twofold nature of our recovery program, physical and mental. And the third member of the pair, physical sobriety, coupled with the AA way of life. Now it's very easy for us to come here in a state of temporary surrender. And get physically sober. It's very easy. And if our alcoholism has been very bad, physical sobriety is sufficient sometimes for months, sometimes for years, because it's new and it's different. And we can live in sobriety and enjoy it, just physical sobriety. But sooner or later, unless we have coupled it with the AA way of life, life is going to hand us a pill that we can't swallow. And we're going to wake up with an empty glass. I'm one who believes it's just as easy for us to run from ourselves in AA as it is before we came. We run to meetings and we run to 12-step calls and we run to talk and we run and we run and we run. And don't think I think that's bad if we're still sober, because I don't. I think that anything that keeps an alcoholic sober for any length of time is a good thing. But the time comes when we have to quit running. I believe that one of the best yardsticks we can use on ourselves is not how far we have been or how much we have stopped, but how good company am I for myself when I'm all alone with God, as I understand. I believe that's one of the best yardsticks that we can use. Not how fast am I going, but how do I feel when I stop? And when there's no one around at all to tell them how fast I've been going. Just me and God. Until we get honest enough to practice these principles in all of our affairs. In all things. And thus have life put back together for us, one piece. I feel that we have very little security. Because after all, since the drinking is a living problem, the answer must also be a living answer. Physical sobriety coupled with the AA way of life. And now I'd like to dream with you for a little bit. Thinking, perhaps, of the reasons behind our becoming alcoholics. Thinking, perhaps, of the difference in the alcoholic personality and the non-alcoholic personality as we see it. It was awfully difficult for me in my drinking career when people would say to me, Chuck, you can't drink, you gotta quit. I didn't know why I couldn't drink. Nobody ever told me. And I'd say to myself, why can't I drink? You know? Because most of the time there were pipsqueaks telling me this. People that didn't have anything like my physique and certainly nothing like my intellect. And they could drink and I couldn't. And it didn't make sense. And it still doesn't answer the problem for me when I read after one authority that says that we were born with a physical inability to react normally to alcohol and were doomed to be alcoholics from birth if we drank liquor. And then read of another authority who says it's the damaging effect of alcohol itself. And then know that there are only 6 million of us who are alcoholic and 65 million people that drink. That don't add up to me at all. And so I've been playing with it for a long time, and this seems to me to make sense. And this is the part of the thing I don't understand. That's the reason I'm telling you it's a dream, you know? But it's been my happy privilege to meet alcoholics all the way from the Hawaiian Islands to New York, all over the country in the last many years. And it seems to me that we're one cloth. We're all alike. It doesn't make any difference, it seems, whether we be priests or preachers or rabbis or doctors or lawyers or bootblacks or streetwalkers or black or white or red or green.
We're all alike. We have the same experiences going down and the same experiences coming back. And the only difference between me and you is that the things that happen to me, and the things that happen to you. Time, place, and degree is just about all the difference there is in our experience. And it seems that there are many characteristics that are common to all of us. Now, in my case, there were six of us, six kids in the family. And we came along, boy, girl, boy, girl, boy, girl. And I was either the first or the last. I was the middle of the sandwich. I was third. Not the seventh son of the seventh son or something like that, you know. And not the eldest or the youngest, so that there's any blame could be laid there, but just in the middle of the day. And I'm the only alcoholic in the bunch. I'm the only black sheep in the lot. Now, we all had the same mother and the same father, presumably. We all had the same food. We all went to the same schools. We all went to the same churches. And yet, I turned out to be an alcoholic. And last year, after the conference in New York, Mrs. Chamberlain and I visited all five of these kids. And we found them all doing very nicely. They all have their own lives and their own families, and they're doing pretty good. And we got back home, and we were sitting talking this thing over. I said, honey, it's wonderful to see the kids all doing so well. None of them are in want, and they seem to have a pretty good life, each of them. But you know something? If I had to live like any one of them, I'd rather be on Skid Row tonight. And I would. And this is the reason I think that I became an alcoholic. Because I never could live like that. We are people who never could settle for the so-called norm in our lifetime. I don't believe that we ever do a normal breath in our life, even before we ever took that first drink. And this seems to be the way it was with me. I think that every person that is born with some sort of an interior awareness that life can be beautiful. I think it's common to mankind because of his origin. Wordsworth put it something like this in a couple of lines in one of his poems. He says, not in complete forgetfulness, nor yet in utter nakedness, but trailing clouds of glory did we come from heaven, which is our home. And I like that. And I think with all of us, there is some sort of an awareness of that kind. But I think with the alcoholic, it is very paramount in his nature. And I think this is the thing that caused us to have this idealistic setup about us. Every one of us are perfectionists. Every alcoholic that I've ever known, regardless of background, is a perfectionist. Never have we been able to settle for the so-called norm. This is the thing that caused the very power drive that is the alcoholic. This is the reason that we have heard these remarks. This is the best salesman we've ever had in the organization, but the best doctor that has been in this part of the country, but the best stenographer that we've ever had in the office. But you can't get down here till long about of a Tuesday. This power drive that also forced us to set goals for ourselves that were impossible of attainment due to our conditioning, our early conditioning. And the great disappointment that came with the lack of attaining these goals. This is the thing that made it impossible for us to accept second place. If we were playing football and didn't get elected captain, we couldn't play it. We wouldn't play the game. We couldn't. Because that was necessary to us. This is the thing also that made the sordid, the lie, the cheat, and all of that thing distasteful to us from the beginning. Oh, I'll agree with you that we had to suffer it all on the way down. Everybody else. But it was always no good for us. I'm mindful of the time I started in business down in my country. 1922 it was. With a set of ideals high as the moon. And I wasn't in business very long until I saw that people didn't perform according to my ideals. And I didn't like it. People lied to each other, and that wasn't according to my standards. People cut each other's throats to get ahead. I didn't like it. It wasn't very long after I had gotten into business that I established bets with everyone in the office who had bet with me, that anyone that made an appointment and showed up on time would drive up with an out-of-state license on his car, and I made money from scratch. And so I didn't like this, and this, I think, is the basis for the disease of alcoholism. I think I became an alcoholic because of my inability to integrate myself into a society that I did not approve of. And I couldn't get out of. And about that time I found liquor. And it made it a little bit easier for me to get along in this society when I had two or three slugs under my belt. But there was a catch to it. Because when I drank, my performance wasn't very good either. And there was self-condemnation. We knew that we weren't living according to the pattern. And there was self-condemnation. And so the self-condemnation caused us to drink more, and the drinking more caused our performance to be less. And condemnation greater. And it snowballed, and it snowballed, and eventually we were caught inside of it, and we couldn't get out. And eventually the time came when we couldn't even get what we had to have out of alcohol, and that was oblivion. And all the way down, this terrible feeling that we weren't performing according to our own pattern, that we were inadequate to live. And I'll tell you how rough it got on me. In my last 5 or 6 years, I always finished up my drunks in bed. Being a periodic, I tapered on. I never tapered off. I'd come off one of these drunks and get well and get in condition and analyze my last drunk and get everything all pigeonholed where it belonged. And get strong enough that I couldn't get drunk anymore, and then I'd start sampling. And I sampled myself right on back to bed. And I'd finish up all my drunks in bed, drinking the cart around. And we had a fruit tree out in the backyard, a tropical fruit tree of some kind that had a lot of fruit on it in the summertime, and the birds ate the fruit. And there's seeds, there were lots of seeds in this thing, and the seeds stayed on, and the blue jays ate the seeds during the winter. And I'd be lying back there in that bed drunk, rolling and tumbling and dying and sweating and freezing, and it had come along about 10 minutes before daylight. And a pair of these blue jays had come and sit down in that tree and start squawking to each other. And it reminded me that now in a few minutes, daylight was coming. A new day. And I wasn't going to be at work. I was going to be lying there in that bed drunk. And just because they were reminding me of what a bum I was, I developed a terrific resentment towards those blue jays. And as the days and the months go by, I developed a hatred. And I hated those things worse than poison. And I'd lie there in my drunken stupor and figure out ways and means to trap him. Or I could have gotten my two-bladed gun and shot him, I reckon, and gotten rid of him, but I was too good for the thing. I was going to trap him, get him alive. And when I caught him, I was going to pull the feathers out of him one at a time. And when I got him stripped naked, I was going to stick him back in one at a time. And all because they were telling me what a bum I was, that I wasn't fit to live. Before I go ahead, I want to tell you what happened those days. When I got sober, I got talking to them, and they started talking back to me. And it wasn't long until I had them sitting in my hand taking nuts. And I've still got them. Maybe this is the third or fourth generation. And all I have to do is to go to my back step and whistle and call, "Come here, Squawker," and they'll come and sit in my hand and get these nuts. And I've learned much from them. Because they'll come and get a nut and take it over there and hide it and put a clot on it. And they'll come back in 2 weeks and go right over there and pick up the clot and get the nut. And I can't even find the shirt in my dresser drawer. I love those blue jays. And when the time finally came when I could drink the stuff by the tumbler, and it wouldn't even give me the oblivion that I had to have. Oh, I'd go out for 30 or 40 minutes, and then I was up and about, and no place to be up and about. And I was suspended between nothing and nothing, and I couldn't get drunk, and I couldn't get sober, and I was just crazy. And there had to be a change, because I could no longer live with me. And I woke up in the middle of January, 9 years ago last January, in the middle of the worst and the best drunk that I've ever had so far, because to date the last. I've been going since the Friday before Christmas, the middle of January, doing nothing but drinking, just pouring it down, 24 hours a day. And I was loaded. I was full of the stuff. I couldn't have been fuller of it. But I woke up on this particular morning with a clear head. For the first time, I guess, in my adult life, I looked at me without looking through my mother-in-law or any other excuse. I just looked at me, and I saw what was there. And it wasn't anything. And I knew without knowing why that I was all done. And I knew without knowing why that I couldn't get out of this thing alone, that I must have help. And I remembered in that little period of sanity that I had read Jack Alexander's article in 1941. And I vowed to myself that if I ever got well enough to get out of that bed, I was going to find Alcoholics Anonymous. And then I lapsed into insanity again. And I had to go through all that period of sobering up, and it wasn't easy. And I had to die and sweat and freeze. And I said to myself a million times, "This too will pass away," and I knew that this was the money that was going to do the passing. But eventually I started to get well. And since this was an anonymous program, my wife and I didn't know how to find it. It never occurred to us to look in the phone book. And so we started calling people that we knew, asking them if they knew of anyone who was in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I finally found a telephone number, and I called a gentleman. And he was a picture man, and he was working nights, and he couldn't take me to a meeting. And day after day, I called him. And always he'd say tomorrow, and finally I called him one day, and I said, "Look, I'm getting panicky. Where can I go?" And it was Sunday. And he told me where there was a meeting, and I walked into it alone. And I heard this preamble and these 12 steps read for the first time. And I couldn't believe my ears. I couldn't believe that a bunch of drunks like me had worked out this wonderful program. It seemed to me that I'd come home. And I left the meeting with two things. I knew I wanted this thing more than life itself. But I had a great fear because I didn't think I had enough left to get it. I had no health and no sanity. And it seemed that it was just out of my reach. But I wanted it so badly that I was in a meeting every night. Every night of the week I was in a meeting. And I'd pick up one or two little things and take them home with me and think about them until the next night when I was in another meeting. And when I was able, I started going early to help them put the chairs around and waiting to pick up the ashtrays and the coffee cups because I wanted so much to be a part of this thing. And after the meetings, I would eavesdrop. I was the greatest eavesdropper in AA, I think. Because just as soon as I could hold a cup of coffee without spilling it all down my front, I'd get a cup of coffee and then back up to somebody that seemed to be talking good AA. And eavesdrop on them until they caught me, and then I'd take off and eavesdrop on somebody else. And when they'd stop me and share their experience, strength, and hope with me, I'd have to go off in the dark and cry. Because here were people that didn't even know me. And they were willing to help me when those that knew me wouldn't even speak to me. And after 6 months of this, I woke up to the fact that I was sober. Just all of a sudden, I woke up to the fact that I was sober and had been all the time. And that's 8.5 years ago. That's 9 years, 8.5 years ago for this experience now. And everything that's happened in my life in the last 8.5 years has just happened. And I have to look back to see why and how. And this seems to me to be the way it happened. On the very first night, I saw that I had already taken both halves of step one in bed that morning. I had already admitted that I was powerless over alcohol, that my life had become unmanageable. I would have liked so much to believe that some power, any power, could restore me to sanity. I was nuts and I knew it. That word didn't bother me at all, that word insanity. I knew I was crazy. People are not crazy, don't have to slap pictures off the wall. But I did. And I would have liked also to take step three. I had no objection to the third step. We made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. I would have loved to do that, but I couldn't. I didn't think it was even reasonable to believe that I could give the mess that was me to anybody, let alone to God. I hated my internal workings, and I figured he did too. But I would have liked very much to take the step. And so I latched onto the last 30-12. And practice these principles in all of our affairs. And I can never recommend that too highly, because that's all I've done after first fulfilling the condition. And so far as I am concerned, when we do it that way, we get all the help we need from this power greater than ourselves. Because that's the way it happened to me. To practice these principles in all of our affairs after first fulfilling the conditions. And what are the conditions? Surrender, complete and utter. A life led by self-will can hardly be satisfactory. Two, the recognition of the need for help, and that's all we need in the first place, in my opinion. Just the recognition of the need for help from a power greater than ourselves. And third, an honest effort to live according to these principles one day at a time. And perhaps the key word is self-honesty. To be honest enough to see ourselves as we are, and honest enough to try to clear up the mess, to clean up the wreckage of the past. And that's it. So many people say to me, well, if it's that simple, how come so many of us have trouble? And to me, that's simple also. There are just a few things. And I believe the first one is our inability to surrender completely and stay surrendered and continue to surrender. We want to hold out a little. And I think about the best example of this I've ever seen. We had a great big good-looking young butcher come to us out in the Beverly Hills Stag Group. And this old boy says, you know, I came here before I lost everything. He says, I still owned my shop, had a little dough in the bank, but I was on the skids and the skids were greased and I was sliding fast and I thought I'd better find a way out. So he says, I'd heard of Alcoholics Anonymous and I came to you. And he says, you know something? I liked your program. And I liked you guys. And he says, I even liked the God part of it for sobriety. But I didn't want him in my butcher shop. He says, I figured if I wanted to weigh my thumb, that had nothing to do with my sobriety at all. So he says, in effect, I said to the old man, look, you can help me with my sobriety. I need you there, but just stay out of my butcher shop. And he says, you know something? It didn't work. It didn't work at all. But he says, now I got me a partner in the meat business, too. And he says, everything's going fine. Our inability to surrender completely causes us a lot of trouble. And secondly, our impatience. We alcoholics have never been known for patience. Always we wanted everything to happen yesterday, you know? And we come here in a temporary state of surrender and we get sober and we think on us it looks awful good. We think everybody should recognize it right quick and start telling us what a great guy we are, you know? It's a great thing, we're sober. We forget old Aunt Tilda's been sober for 92 years and nobody's ever elected her queen of the May. Never had a drink in her life, and she isn't running around expecting that, you know? And we think that our life should immediately fall into place, and all of our troubles should disappear. The wife should come home, and the bill collectors should stay off of her backs, and everything else. Impatience. We forget that it took us years, in my case, 25 years, one day at a time, walking down those stairs to get where I was. And we forget that we have to go from where we are to where we're going. And we have to do it one day at a time, just walking up these stairs one day at a time. Impatience gets us in a lot of trouble. And lastly, we hear some monkey like me get up here and say that he thinks that it's necessary for us to get help from a power greater than ourselves. And we read in the book where it says we need help from a power greater than ourselves. And we read that third step and it says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it. And we say, uh-oh, I don't understand him. I got to have me another book. And we run and we get another book and we start reading again. And we start running and reading and running. And we forget that that 12th step says, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps. And it don't say a word about another book. And I am one who believes that when we fulfill the conditions of this program, we have a spiritual awakening and we can't help it. Because when we practice these principles one day at a time over any considerable period of time, we wake up to the fact that we've already moved out of hell into heaven and we have to thank God. Oh, I'm not against other books. I read lots of them. But not to find an answer, because I found my answer right here. Living according to these principles one day at a time. after first fulfilling the condition. And I believe that it's impossible for us to fulfill these conditions and walk in this way one day at a time without getting the help that we so sorely need. When we have found our answer, then we can read another book, or we can go to the priest or the preacher or the rabbi, and we know what he's talking about. But I have never seen, heard about, or dreamed about a formula that to me is so effective as this little formula of ours. Surrender, the recognition of the need for help, and honest effort to do these things one day at a time. That's it, in my book. And now I'd like to try and tie this whole thing together in just a couple of minutes. Because I have come to believe that we alcoholics are the most fortunate peoples on the face of the earth. Fortunate because we have an incurable disease. Fortunate because, regardless of our ability to do so, there is no place that we can buy an answer. Fortunate that our only answer is to fulfill these conditions. And that in fulfilling these conditions, we fulfill the conditions of the good life. We fulfill the conditions of God. And I have come to bless the day that I became an alcoholic. And not only do I bless the day, but my good non-alcoholic wife also blesses the day. And our children bless the day. Because it was through this that we all came back home. And so, I see that it was just as necessary for me to go to become an alcoholic. Just as necessary for me to spend those 10 years in hell as it was to be born in the first place. Because I could not fulfill the conditions. I could not surrender. In 43 years, I never surrendered to anybody, man, woman, God, or the devil. Not once. I couldn't. It wasn't in my vocabulary, that word. I had the four, I don't want to call them sins, I'll call them defective characters. Four of them, any one of which would have kept me drunk 1,000 years. But I had four of them to the nth degree. Pride, ego, intellectual snobbery, and self-righteousness. I was a good man. I kept telling my wife that. And so I couldn't surrender until I'd burned up. And there was nothing left to be proud of. And it was only after Mrs. C, after 20 years, that sought counsel to get rid of me. And our sons would be glad that I was gone. And the boss was all done with me, and I was all done with myself. Only when I saw that everything that was dear to me was gone, I'd accepted the fact and knew whose fault it was that I could fulfill the condition. And so I blessed the day. And this little parable, to me, ties the whole thing up in one little package. It explains me to me, and explains you to me, and it explains both of us to God, insofar as our relationship is concerned. And it's the little parable of the prodigal son. And it's become so meaningful to me that I can scarcely think of a living problem without thinking about it. But I don't think of it as about two guys, several people, a couple of 1,000 years ago, but rather about you and about me and our relationship to God. And it goes something like this, and please forgive me for my own interpretation of the thing, but this is the way it is meaningful to me. a certain wealthy man, God, had two sons, you and I. And the youngest one of them came to his dad and he said, Dad, give me my inheritance. I've got things to do. I have a lot of schemes of my own. I'm going out to California and I'm going to cut a big swamp out there. Build an empire out there in California. Now the old man didn't say, wait a minute, son, we've got everything you need right here at home. There's no sense in you going out there because you're going to be away from home and you're going to get in trouble. You're going to meet a brunette out there with a bottle of muscadoodle and you're going to get in bad. You're going to get in a lot of bad trouble. Sure as the world. No, he didn't argue with the kid at all. The kid says, give me my inheritance, and he gave it to him. And the kid went into a far country, away from home, away from God, consciously separated from, into a far country, and wasted his substance on riotous living. And I can't even think about this without laughing, because that was me. That was what I did. I don't know whether you did or not, but I did that. Wasted his substance on riotous living. And after he spent all, there arose a mighty famine in the land. And if there are any alcoholics in this room, I think you can understand what a famine does rise. I don't know of any group of people on earth that could better understand a famine. And so, the kid came to want. And what did he do? Did he come back home? No, he did just like we did. He went someplace else. He went to a man in that country. We went to the doctors, to the psychiatrists, to everybody. But the right place. And so, the man put him to work. And above all things, he put him to tending the pigs. Now, this was a Jew boy telling this story, and they don't like pigs at all. They just don't like pigs. So he's telling us the old boy was down. We have a word for it in AA. We call it a low bottom. And he was real low. He was down there. And whilst he was in the pig pen, he got hungry. And he fain would eat the husks that the pigs did eat. And the next line is terrific. And no man gave unto him. I remember those days, four, five, six of them at a time, sitting in my chair there in the living room, waiting for my mind to come back. Any member of the family would have given 10 years of their lives to help me, and they couldn't. I was 10 million miles from nowhere. And no man gave unto him. Our book says probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism, the same thing. And the next line is better than that, because it says, but the kid came to himself. And I remember that morning in January. The kid came to himself and he says, look, I'm a bad boy, I'm a sinner, I'm no good. I've sinned against God and man. I'm no longer fit to be my father's son. But in my father's house there's plenty to spare. The servants back there have more to eat than I have. And he made a decision. He says, I will arise and go to my father. Our book says we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood it, the same thing. And so he got up and started home. And the father saw him a long ways off. And he came to meet him. And the kid started trying to tell him what a bad boy he was. And I'm mindful of that time when I heard this program read for the first time and wanted to turn my will and my life over to the care of God and thought I couldn't because I didn't think it was reasonable to believe that I could give this mess away. And the boy started trying to tell his dad, look, I'm a bad boy, I've sinned, I'm no good. And again, the father didn't hear him. He didn't say, yeah, I know, I've been watching you, I've got the books. I know everything you did out there, and you sure was a bad boy. Now get the grubbing hole and get back here on the back 40 and start to work. Dig up those sassafras bushes and persimmon sprouts for the next 25 years, and if you clean it all up good, I might invite you in to have lunch with me. He didn't say that stuff. He didn't even hear it. He fell on his neck and kissed him. And he put a ring on his finger, the symbol of eternal life. No beginning and no end. And he called the hired servants and he said, kill the fatted calf. The boy was lost and he's come back home. That God could and would, if thought. A living problem and a living answer. And again, in my book, we are the most fortunate amongst men and women. Because we have to find the answer. We came here not for answers to those other problems. Not to find God. Not even hoping for physical health. Let alone peace of mind and joy in being. We started doing these things for one thing, sobriety. And in the very doing, we found the answer to life itself. And what is the answer to the disease of alcoholism? It's nothing in the world but an individually conscious partnership, an individual conscious partnership with God. In the business of living. Personally satisfactory, individual experience. A conscious partnership with God as we understand it. In the business of living. And it's terrific. This is the only easy life that I have ever known. In 52 years, these 9 years are the only easy life I've ever known. This is the only good life I have ever known. And so I have come to believe with all that's in me that we're all God's children, regardless of how far we have strayed into the far country. Always we have been our Father's children, but away from home, consciously separated from. And I have come to believe that this is the one problem that includes all problems. Conscious separation from life, good God. And the only answer, and the answer that includes all answers, is conscious unity with living in a part of. Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God. As we understood. I find this the most fascinating thing on earth. It consumes me. It gets better and better and better as the days and the years roll on. And I'm so grateful I can't see. And if I should sum up my entire philosophy, it would be simply this. And all of it I have learned through the miracle of AA and the God who made the miracle possible. I feel just like a little knot-headed kid hanging on to his dad's hand, walking down the corridors of life, thinking it not strange to ask for and receive guidance in all things, thinking it not strange to share everything, the good and the bad, with my partner in the business of living, and thinking it not strange to go about my Father's business in all things. Yes. There is sobriety here. There is for physical sobriety here. But there is infinitely more. There is the AA way of life. And I shall never cease to thank God that you shared your experience, strength, and hope with me. I shall never cease to thank God that I decided I wanted what you had and was willing to go to any length to get it. And I'll never cease to thank God that I decided to take these steps. These 12 steps. These steps that lead all the way from hell to heaven. I know because that's what happened to me. Thank you very much.